Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrig, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, Spotlight History, Marriage and Family as Viewed in Ecumenical Councils at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome. And Focus Lent, in two totally different features, both in terms of tone and content. As Benedict XVI's spiritual exercises are about to begin, we take a look at the prayer life of John Paul II. And on a lighter note, we join our popular Latin lover as he tells us about spiritual exercises in the Vatican. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. There's nothing the Dean of Church History at the Pontifical Gregorian University, Jesuit Norman Tanner, doesn't know about ecumenical councils. The title of his most recent book, with its bright red dust jacket featuring St. Peter's, to be published on April 21st, is a giveaway in this respect. It's a new short history of the Catholic Church. That's why when the Faculty of Canon Law, this year's hosts at the Gregorian of the 2011 Dies Academicus, or Academic Day, decided to focus on the theme of marriage and family, Professor Tanner was asked to speak on this theme related to the ecumenical councils of the Church. I went over to the university to find out more about his talk. Stay tuned.
Ecumenical councils, that's councils of the whole church, that's what the word ecumenical means, councils of the whole church, and we have 21 of them, and going from Nicaea in 325 to Vatican II in the 1960s. Marriage and the family obviously is something absolutely essential to human life, and what has been the Christian, the Catholic contribution in terms of teaching. We start with the example of Christ and what we're told in the Old and New Testament. Provides a basis, of course, for all subsequent teaching in the Catholic Church and the Christian Church as a whole. But nevertheless, we have these councils which began in 325 with the First Council of Nicaea, which have added various elements, as you might say, or have made more explicit what we already find in the teaching of Christ and in the New Testament. On the whole, you can say that marriage and the family has been taken as so important and so central that there hasn't been a huge amount of legislation about marriage and the family in these councils. And now that might sound a bit surprising because we know that marriage and the family occupies the church a great deal today. We think of contraception, mixed marriages, all sorts of other issues concerning marriage and the family, which the church has had to make statements about. But over the course of the centuries, there's been a remarkable degree of agreement amongst Christians, both the Catholics, the Orthodox, and the Protestant churches of the Reformation, about the importance of marriage, the centrality of marriage, and the basic teaching on marriage, which we find in the New Testament and Old Testament. So, in a way, these councils have had to deal with small issues regarding marriage. First of the councils, the First Council of Nicaea in 325. You might say, why did the church have to wait 325 years before it could have one of these general gatherings? Well, the answer is obvious, really. The first three centuries of the church were times of persecution, and it was impossible to have a gathering of all the bishops of the church together. But with the conversion of Constantine in the early 300s, for the first time we have the possibility of a gathering of bishops, and the bishops have always been the core members of these ecumenical councils, which gathered at Nicaea in modern Turkey, close to Istanbul today. Interestingly, mainly concerned this Council with the Creed, of course, the Creed which, as we recite every Sunday, what we call the Nicene Creed, that basic profession of faith, and that's the most important contribution of that Council. But the Council also did grapple a little bit with the question of marriage, and especially the question of the possibility of marrying a second time. And there is one decree, which is a canon of the Council, which is a little difficult to interpret, and it's not quite clear whether it's allowing actually second marriages, even while both the partners, husband and wife, are still alive, and therefore whether it's allowing divorce, or whether it was speaking rather about a second marriage after the death of the husband or wife. It's a very interesting decree and important, but again, emphasizing the importance of marriage and also understanding about the difficulties of marriage. I think that's very important. These councils, sometimes the legislation, the wording is quite severe to our modern ears, but basically these councils are always very supportive and indeed understanding of the difficulties of marriage. Wonderful contract which a man and a woman undertake as a lifetime undertaking. So we do have this interesting brief mention of marriage in that First Council of Nicaea. Later councils, I think in a similar line, are very much supportive of marriage and don't say a great deal, precisely because its importance and the basic nature of marriage, of starting with the contract and the love between the husband and wife and their duties towards their children, was taken for granted as the foundation of marriage. So we do have that wonderful basis and continuity in the teaching of marriage through the centuries. And as mentioned, it's something which is held together. It's a very ecumenical teaching and indeed survived the sad split between the Eastern and Western Church, which happened in 1054, the Catholic and Orthodox Church. But on the point of view of marriage, there has always been agreement. It wasn't a cause of the division. And likewise, at the time of the Reformation indeed, although we know that many of the reformers would not accept the celibacy of the clergy, nevertheless, on the point of view of marriage itself, it was not a point in dispute between Catholics and Protestants, the Catholic Church and the Church of the Reformation. There was agreement on the centrality and importance of marriage. So at the Great Council of Trent in the 1540s, 1550s, it lasted 18 years and really in many ways defined modern Catholicism, we have important decrees on marriage, saying how important marriage is, and also decrees regarding the ceremony in the church, the bands of marriage, all the dimensions of marriage which we are familiar with today, very much date from that decree of the Council of Trent. It's often referred to, the decree, as tam etsi, because that's the first word in the decree in Latin. All the decrees, of course, of Trent were written and spoken in Latin. But again, a decree which is very much a common ground between Catholics and Protestants. And that's a very beautiful thing to remember, that despite the divisions of the Reformation, we're far more united, Catholics, Protestants, Orthodox, than we are divided. And the unity on the point of marriage is a very beautiful example of that, and the teaching of Trent reinforces that point. I think then we'd come finally to Vatican II, which is one of the first councils after Trent, really, which has an extended treatment of marriage. And we find that in the last of the decrees of Vatican II to be promulgated, published, perhaps one of the best of it, known of its decrees, called Gaudium et Spes, Hope and Joy, the decree which is explicitly addressed to the Church in the modern world. And we have a whole section, a small chapter on marriage, in which, again, the importance of marriage and the family and very important to put the two together, as it were. Family, normally an integral part of marriage, is put there together in quite an extended treatment in a very positive and sympathetic manner, one which both praises the high ideals of marriage, images the unity which we have with God, and indeed, in a sense, images the unity within the Trinity itself. So we have the high ideals of marriage very well presented by Vatican II, but also it's a chapter which is very understanding of the difficulties of marriage. It's a wonderful and great undertaking, but, well, of course, I'm a celibate priest, so who am I to speak? But I know from, as it were, from all my wonderful friends and family and so on, that marriage is a wonderful but difficult undertaking which requires great courage. And I think you'd say the Vatican II decree is very much an encouragement to young people to undertake that great adventure of marriage, the great undertaking, and to persevere despite the many difficulties. And maybe today you can say marriage can be even more difficult than it was at the time of Vatican II. Much of the society, the atmosphere in many countries makes married life difficult. The amount of pressure on work makes it difficult for families to enjoy time together. Saturday and Sunday often is taken over by work. It's difficult also for families to undertake their religious duties, and there we find in Vatican II and other documents the importance of a family which not only stays together but also prays together. So family attendance at Sunday Mass and family prayers in the evening, a wonderful way of sustaining this great institution, what is the best word, this great gift that God gave to us right from the beginning, as it were, with Adam and Eve, and has been developed through the Jewish tradition, the Muslim tradition, the tradition of other religious, great religions, and our own Christian church. So if you want one recommendation, read that beautiful little section on Vatican II's decree, Gaudium et Spes, the Church and the Modern World. You'll find it in Part 2, Chapter 1, the beautiful six-page summary of marriage and its great ideals, as well as sympathy for the difficulties and help with the difficulties that married people and children indeed will find. And it's also very helpful for us priests, because we have been given this, as Catholic priests, a wondrous gift of invitation to celibacy, but our celibacy is very much at the service of married people. And so it's very helpful, the example of married people, for our own lives too as priests.
You've talked about all the councils as a historian, but as a historian, if we had a council today, what issues do you think would be up for discussion?
It's a good question, because although I was going to say so much has been said in Vatican II, certainly things have moved on. Perhaps the question of mixed marriages, not only between Catholics and Protestant and Orthodox, which was, or especially Catholics and Protestants, which was very much an issue at the time of Vatican II, but now, of course, much more, you might say, interfaith marriages, where Catholics or Christians marry Muslims or Hindus or people of different or no particular faiths. So I think that would certainly be a point which any new ecumenical council would be wise to tackle, but perhaps even more important, to face up to the real difficulties of simply living a married life in today's world. The fact that in so many countries, Sunday is not a free day, it's a day of work. There's great pressure on people to work. How can Catholics, as it were, live in a multicultural, multi-faith, and frequently in a very hostile atmosphere? And how can they maintain the integrity of their faith, even in situations of difficult compromise? I think it would help Catholics within the Catholic community, but also help them to live in the realities of today's world, which is sort of both multi-faith, multicultural.
Is there a particular figure which stands out in terms of the issue of marriage and family?
I think you could say it's the whole Christian communities which has been the great personality, and that's why the councils haven't said a great deal about marriage and the family, precisely because it's been such an accepted and part of Christian life. So I think we can be grateful to all the Christian families who've lived this difficult vocation. And so the councils have, for the most part, simply in a quiet way, encouraged what lay people were already doing at their best. However, we can be especially grateful for the treatment, the extended treatment of marriage at Vatican II. This was not due to any one particular person, but there were a group of people, a group of the bishops, who were very keen to promote this decree, Gaudium et Spes, the Church in the Modern World. They wanted a document which would speak today. So, yes, we could say that I think Pope John the 23rd, who has been recently beatified, Blessed John the 23rd, this final decree of Vatican II, Gaudium et Spes, the Church in the Modern World, was very much close to his heart even before the council began. He said he wished the council to be a pastoral council and one which helped people in today's world. So, yes, surely I would say that John the 23rd, in his encouragement, it was he, after all, who called the Second Vatican Council and particularly wished for this pastoral dimension of the Church, which came out most especially in that decree, Gaudium et Spes, and in which the chapter on marriage and the family is very central. So, yes, I'd be very pleased to salute Pope John the 23rd above all.
And while our thanks there go to the Dean of Church History at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome, Professor Norman Tanner, as mentioned a moment ago, I'd like to focus on the Lenten season by sharing with you a feature I put together in view of Benedict XVI's spiritual exercises, which have as focus this year the light of Christ at the heart of the Church, John Paul II and the theology of saints. Picking up on this theme, which will be at the heart of the meditations presented by Carmelite François-Marie Latelle, and ahead, of course, of the beatification of this Polish pontiff, I thought I'd shine the spotlight on his prayer life, as viewed by someone who witnessed it firsthand. He's Jesuit and Cardinal Roberto Tucci. One last word. This interview was done shortly before the late John Paul II's death.
The capacity of the Holy Father to isolate himself from whatever is happening around him and concentrate in prayer. And for a long time, not only, when we were visiting a church, he would stay 10 minutes, a quarter of an hour, the altar where the Blessed Sacrament was kept, and I was anxious about the program, because perhaps we were already late, but also in his own chapel. And even during the Pope's visit to different countries in the morning, in the Nunciature, generally we were living in the Nunciature, the Holy Father, he would stay minimum 3/4 of an hour alone in the chapel, very first in the morning. being in the same situation, I would have been able also to pray a little bit, but I would be more interested in the rehearsal of the speeches he had to give during the day. As a man, continuous dialogue with our Lord, with our Lady, the Madonna, Mother of God. Even when we were having meetings in order to prepare the Pope's visit to one or the other country, I remember that we would start always to pray a good 10 minutes in the chapel before meal, and then again after meal, returning to the chapel for another rather long prayer. His great devotion to Our Lady, the Mother of God, it depends both of his Polish roots and also on a thing which is not Polish at all. Because his devotion with his coat of arms, Totus Tuus, doesn't come from Poland, comes from France. Because he took that from Grignion de Montfort, a canonized French saint, and a simple tailor, who had a great influence on the devotion, the personal devotion of this Pope. It was Tiranovsky. It was a very simple person, but a great influence on him. They provided the Holy Father with copies of works of St. John of the Cross, of Teresa of Avila, and of Grignion de Montfort. So you see, is a Pole in the sense of strict connection with his own cultural, social, historical roots, at the same time open to other cultures.
Spending a lot of time in prayer, was it difficult to work with him when you prepared his travels?
No, because I think that probably the capacity of facing difficult problems depends also on the fact that he discusses, I think, those problems with the Lord. Caring about the different problems of the world, different problems of the church in different countries and so on. So I think that is a way of a meditation. Together, praying, he meditates about problems. So for that reason, then he can face without, perhaps he doesn't need so much information through dossier, but he draws the important information from the people, who are already well informed, especially if they are coming from the countries where the Pope had to go and visit, but also from this capacity to concentrate in prayer about problems. You know that when I visited Poland, Krakow, I discovered, for me it was a discovery, but anyway, that the Holy Father, when he was Archbishop there, he would write his own personal important documents kneeling in his chapel, where they had prepared for him a special kneeling,
Prie-Dieu.
Which was where he was able even to write. And there was a lamp, so he could, even in the night or in the evening, he could work kneeling or seated, but in front of the Blessed Sacrament.
Thanks there to Jesuit Cardinal Roberto Tucci for sharing his memories of John Paul II with us. Now, on a dramatically different note, I'd like to join our popular Latin lover, Carmelite Father Reginald Foster. who, among other things, was Latinist to John Paul II. But do stay tuned as I chat to him of spiritual exercises in the Vatican. Father, when one feels one's not worth a pin, it may be time to do one's spiritual exercises. How would you translate that?
Well, cum se quis sentit a nihili esse, nihili esse. Tunc tempus est ut exercitia spiritualia faciat.
To find light at the end of a tunnel.
Ut lumen in extremo cuniculo reperiat. That you can, all this stuff is easy. That's easy.
So as to change our spiritual lives in a twinkling of an eye.
Ictu oculi, the famous twinkling of an eye. Ut ictu oculi vitam nostram spiritualem mutare possimus.
And give our spiritual lives a bit of spit and polish.
Spit and polish, my lord. Oh, per polire, you'd probably say to just polish. Would vitam nomare, they wouldn't say that. The Romans wouldn't say that. But anyway.
They wouldn't be so vulgar.
No, they wouldn't. They would vitam nostram spiritualem perficiamus. Although spit and polish would be perpoliamus, that we polish off our spiritual lives, but these Cicero wouldn't understand that expression. It's just something else.
At any rate, now I want to speak about something serious, which are spiritual exercises in the Vatican, a practice which began in 1929, the year of the Lateran Pax.
I didn't know that.
With Pius XI, obviously, who admired St. Ignatius. Well, how does one say spiritual exercises?
Well, the exercitia spiritualia.
That comes from straight from Latin.
Yes, the first translations of St. Ignatius in Latin had that.
In my Catholic school, we used to say we would go on retreat.
Retreat is ad recessum. Recessum spiritualem ire. Recessum, to go in the background. That we can say, it's very beautiful. So the fact is, the way I live is in recessu perpetuo. I'm always on some sort of a retreat because, like, I'm all alone in my room. That's a recesso, to be off.
At any rate, the people who live in the Vatican, headed by the Pope, they go on spiritual exercises each year.
He goes on exercises.
The Pope goes on spiritual exercises, and then and the papal household accompanies him. How does one say papal household?
Well, that's the Domus Pontificia, the pontifical house.
In 1922, there was an apostolic constitution, Summorum Pontificum. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right, so far.
Named in which St. Ignatius was proclaimed patron of spiritual exercises. You mentioned St. Ignatius tied to spiritual exercises, no?
Yes.
In fact, many of the preachers of these retreats in the papal household were Jesuits.
Yes, yes, and that's the terminology came down from that. I'd like to know, you don't know any of the next words of Summorum Pontificum.
No.
But my students would go crazy over that kind of a beginning of a pontifical document of the Roman pontiffs. And of course, in Latin, you don't know what's happening.
Why?
Well, because you don't know how the sentence is going to end. The will of the Roman pontiffs, the custom of the Roman pontiffs, but the document begins with Summorum Pontificum.
And heartfelt thanks there to Carmelite Father Reginald Foster, better known as our popular Latin lover. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. Laudetur Jesus Christus.